Good morning, I'm Paul, host of the New P&L podcast and founder of the New P&L Brand Purpose Institute, where we work with business leaders, employees and entrepreneurs just like you, and we empower them to build brands with purpose on purpose. So if you have a question about how to build more engaged, creative and collaborative cultures and leaders, we'd love to chat. Just get in touch at principlesandleadership.com. This week, our shout out goes out to Egypt, another one of the 90-plus countries the New P&L has now listened to in. A massive thank you to all of our Egyptian listeners for your ongoing support and your belief in our global movement for more principled leadership and more purpose-led business. You are an important part of this movement. And if you'd like to keep it growing, I encourage you to send a link or a recommendation to your colleagues, your managers, your business networks right across Egypt. Let's keep the global movement for a new P&L growing. This week, we speak to Juliette Marie Somerset, CEO and Managing Partner of Somerset Capital, based in Menlo Park in Silicon Valley. Juliette Marie is a tech investor, advisor, and mentor in early-stage global tech startups and social impact scale-ups, and sits on a number of boards of directors and advisors of tech startups, tech incubators, and accelerators right across the globe, including Norskin Impact Accelerator, UniRock Partners, NASDAQ Entrepreneurial Center, the Swiss-based CV Labs, and Yale University. Throughout a career spanning over 30 years, first as a Wall Street investment banker and now as a tech advisor, investor, and mentor, Juliette Marie has consistently been a leader and champion of diversity and inclusion. She is passionately and fiercely dedicated to empowering other women leaders, game-changing tech innovators, and underrepresented entrepreneurs globally. So Juliette Marie, a very warm welcome to the New P&L. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, Paul, for having me.
My pleasure. Perhaps we could start the conversation with you giving listeners a quick introduction into what you do and who you do it for.
Great. Well, I am the CEO and managing partner at Somerset Capital, which is based in Menlo Park, Silicon Valley. And I've been there for the past 12 years. I've been a tech advisor, mentor, and investor during this past 12 years for early stage startups, global startups and scale-ups, particularly with a social impact focus. I'm on the advisory board of UniRock Partners, which is based in Brisbane, your part of the world, Queensland. And it's an investment firm. I'm also on the board of several other tech companies. One that is of particular interest, Scott McNally, who was the co-founder of Sun Microsystems. Mm-hmm. So he and I are advising a Silicon-based startup, Minerva QC, which is an AI-powered company. Mm-hmm. And we're very excited about this new venture. I'm also on the board of Norskin Impact Accelerator, which is based in Stockholm, Sweden. And I am a mentor at the NASDAQ Entrepreneur Center, which is based in San Francisco, and Crypto Valley Labs, which is based in Crypto Valley, Switzerland, which is right outside of Zurich. Mm-hmm. And I teach at ESCP, which is based in Berlin. It's a leading business school.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised you have the time to do this podcast.
Well,
I'm very grateful. That's quite a resume. You are globally respected as a pioneer in the tech and the fintech and the startup spaces. You've been breaking glass ceilings for women of color and indeed all women for more than 30 years. However, investment in female-led and majority-owned startups in the tech space still remains stubbornly low, still in the single figures in terms of percentages. What is your view of the, what's the sea change that needs to happen to really lift or accelerate this change in terms of investment in woman-owned businesses?
Well, Paul, the good news is that the sea change has started.
Yes.
It started a few years ago when we had a wave of women being promoted as general partners at some of the leading venture capital firms. And this opened up the door for more female founders to receive venture backing.
Yes.
There, for many years, was a bias towards female and male founders. I sat in on some of the investment committees, and surprisingly, women were asked different questions than men. It was just assumed that the men had an understanding of profit and loss and business IQ. But women have the same knowledge and expertise.
Yes. Where does it go then in the next 5 to 10 years in terms of the sea change? If it started to happen, what does the next 5 to 10 years look like in terms of investment right across the tech space, female and male majority owned tech and startups?
Well, I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we are going to see more people like Melinda French Gates stepping up and just spotlighting that gender disparity.
Yes.
And also backing that gap with substantial funding. She's committed $1 billion of her own money to ensure that we do have gender equality and gender parity in venture capital.
Mm-hmm.
And there are more Melinda French Gates, thankfully.
Absolutely. We are in the middle of tremendous global turmoil at the moment, and often tumultuous times are quite a fertile breeding ground for innovation. That sort of challenge breeds the necessity for innovation. If we do slip into a period of recession over the next 12 to 18 months, where do you see the bright spots for technology investment, and why do you see them there?
Well, there are many bright spots, especially in tech and innovation. The great marvel of tech and innovation is that it's never static. It's always dynamic. It's always forward thinking. And if we look at past recessions, and if we look at past economic crises, some of the leading tech companies were launched.
Mm-hmm.
And these unicorns are having an impact on our lives today. So we may experience a recession in the coming years or coming months. but I'm very optimistic that the tech ecosystem, the global tech ecosystem, will thrive.
You've mentioned the global tech ecosystem there, and I was reading a report in preparation for this, doing my research, a McKinsey report which highlighted what it described as Europe's increasing technology gap with the US and China. In other words, that Europe is falling behind in a big way from a competitive perspective in comparison to the US and China. And the report cited that when it comes to transversal technologies, AI, quantum computing, biotech, and so on, Europe's lack of scale, as they described it, in these technologies jeopardizes its position. As someone who is working a lot with tech entrepreneurs right across the world, does this reflect your own experience? Do you see that disparity between the US and China and Europe, or is it a bit more nuanced than that, if you like?
It's nuanced, and it's nuanced for this reason. Companies in the US are heavily venture-backed, and the capital is obviously here, and the capital is obviously in China.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why tech companies have, you know, especially in Europe, they're undervalued, but they're also underfunded.
Yes.
You know, in Silicon Valley, within months, you know, multi-billion dollar funds can be raised and are raised. Now, that isn't the case in Europe, but there isn't a lack of tech innovation in Europe. There isn't a lack of scalability in Europe among the tech ecosystem. The funding is just not on the same level as it is in Silicon Valley.
Why is that? Is Europe traditionally more culturally cautious, perhaps? I mean, the money must be there. What is inhibiting that flood of necessary VC investment to the same level as the US?
Well, the venture capital in Europe is a more conservative breed mm-hmm. than it is in America or China. And with that conservative tendency, the investment committees are being careful with deploying the funds. Whereas in Silicon Valley, there's an abundance of venture capital. So with that abundance, the greater risk can be taken.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in your introduction that you are increasingly interested in the social impact side of technology startups, and you mentioned you're a mentor and advisor to Norskin Impact Accelerator. Could you tell me a little bit more about the accelerator, what the principles are that underpin it and its core ambition within that social impact space?
Well, the principles that underpin Norskin are social impact companies can become unicorns. They can become extremely profitable. But in that journey of scaling and being profitable, they can also make an enormous impact on the world, mm-hmm. on billions of people. The founder of Norskin, Nicholas, he was the co-founder of Klarna. Mm-hmm. And like great successful tech unicorns, you know, made a fortune. And with his wealth, he decided to set up Norskin. And, you know, closely aligning it to the UN Sustainable Development Goals. So all the entrepreneurs, all the investors in the ecosystem at Norskin are committed to the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And that's a game changer.
Yeah. There is a perception that is hard to break at the moment, that you either have successful tech innovation businesses or you have social impact innovation businesses. And there's an artificial distinction that is often drawn between the two, that the latter cannot be as profitable as the former, that if you're social impact, you're not necessarily as profitable. Is one of the key principles for Norskin, are they trying to break down that perception that you can deliver profit, you can deliver for the planet, and you can deliver for people? They're not mutually exclusive, if you like.
Yeah, yes, that is a great North Star for Norskin. And that's why it is having enormous success. We have a hub in Rwanda, and next year there will be a hub in Barcelona. And yesterday we had the great announcement that the new co-CEOs will be two dynamic women.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very progressive entrepreneurial ecosystem.
Some evidence, I guess, from your perspective of that sea change that you highlighted
absolutely.
Earlier.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think what happened, Pierre Omidyar, he is a great pioneer in social impact investing. And you know, initially it was philanthropy, and he thought, okay, yes, philanthropy can and does amazing things, but social impact does as well.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps the most prominent example of social impact and its marriage with the corporate world, if you like, is the example of Patagonia recently and its announcement that it would essentially hand its business over to look after the planet. I wondered what your view was on that business model and whether it is, whether it stands out as an outlier because it can't be replicated, or whether you feel it actually sets a good example and a good business model for others to replicate.
I think it definitely raises the bar.
Mm-hmm.
It raises the bar on so many levels, Paul. It raises the bar on good corporate governance. It raises the bar on sustainability, not just greenwashing, but authentic sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
And it raises the bar on role models.
Yes, that's a good point. That's a very good point. And it's, you know, you touched on earlier that you're not only mentoring for Norskin, there are many others you are mentoring and advising for, the NASDAQ Entrepreneurial Center, Yale, and many others. And when you think about those that you are mentoring and that that next generation of leaders and entrepreneurs that are coming through, do you see any characteristics that define them or make them different from the leaders of today? You know, what are those characteristics that are going to define these future leaders within the tech space?
I think what will define them is their ethical leaders, their principled leaders, their impactful leaders, and transformative leaders. I remember when I was doing my MBA, the whole Enron scandal exploded.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, you know, our professors started, you know, putting an emphasis on, if you're going to be a global leader, be ethical.
Yes.
If you're going to be a global leader, don't have scandals under your leadership tenure. And I think as we, with each generation, we're seeing those solid old-fashioned values of do good.
Yes. Do you see that changing the way the VC community invests as well? Because obviously it's one thing to have a startup with principle and purpose, or to come into a business as a leader with principle and purpose, but ultimately it has to be commercially viable as well, and you have to still bend to ensure VC investment. Do you see that sea change coming in the VC community as well? Are they looking for something different in their leadership?
Yes, I do see that happening. I remember when President Emmanuel Macron started his annual Tech for Good Summit.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought together the tech titans of the world in Paris. And it was all about tech for good.
Mm-hmm.
It's all right to be a leader, but be a good leader.
Yes.
That was his message. And I think it is taking seed, not only in sort of the global tech corporate C-suite and boardrooms, but also in venture capital.
Mm. You mentioned there be a good leader, not just a leader. And I've been doing a lot of thinking and reading recently around the rather ubiquitous phrases of market disruption or disruptive technologies. And I wanted to ask your view on the following. What defines market disruption? Because it strikes me as some who claim to be market disruptors are actually, in effect, market destructors. And what I mean by that is when you look at some startups who come into a new market, and claim they have a disruptive technology, they're really just entering that market with a very unsustainable commercial model backed by investors with very deep pockets. And the incumbent players are unable to compete commercially with that. So it's not the technology, but it's the commercial element that are undercutting that business model. And so it destroys a market rather than disrupts it. What are your thoughts on that? You know, we can all think of probably industries where that is fairly obvious, but I'd love to get your view on that.
Well, the late Clayton Christensen, who was based at Harvard in Cambridge, Mass., was once a mentor for me.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of his thinking was around disruption and disruptive innovation.
Yes.
And as you were saying, you know, just because you launch a startup, it's not going to be disruptive. It might be commercially successful,
mm-hmm.
but if it's to really be disruptive, it's going to be like, you know, a Goliath and the giant. It's going to knock that giant down. Mm. And so that's what excites me about the fintech space. These fintech entrepreneurs, they know that the financial system is broken. Mm-hmm. They know that the investment system is broken. And that's why many of them are disruptors.
That's a very interesting point. And I spoke to Dr. Dennis Koh on the show a couple of weeks back, and Dennis oversaw the launch of Tomorrow Digital Bank, which was, for those listeners who aren't familiar, Southeast Asia's first digital bank. And we discussed at length in that conversation the challenges of building and maintaining cultures of innovation in more traditional businesses and industries like the banking sector to, I guess, in some ways, counteract or catch up with those more nimble fintech starters. What is your advice in terms of the key components to creating and maintaining and driving cultures of innovation in some of those more traditional sectors and industries?
Well, I think about the global unbanked community.
Mm-hmm.
It's vast in Africa.
Yes.
It's vast in the Middle East. And I've seen fintechs, you know, knowing that all these people in Africa or the Middle East or other, you know, developing countries have are their cell phones.
Yes.
And they are using the fact that all they have is their cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And they are using fintech technology.
Yes.
To make sure a woman or an individual doesn't have to walk 20 miles to pay a bill. All he or she has to do is do it on a telephone.
Yes.
With a fintech solution. So that's disruption in my mind.
I remember many years ago speaking to an entrepreneur from Israel, and he was an entrepreneur in the digital printing space. And Israel is an incredible hub for digital printing technologies. And I asked him why that was. And he said, because of the establishment of the modern country of Israel in the late 40s, they didn't have the heritage of the old printing technologies and that old thinking. So they came into it with a completely new frame of mind. And I wondered whether the example you've given of fintech technologies in Africa and using the mobile phone, in some regards, are more advanced than Europe and the US in terms of their adoption, because they come at it with a new way of thinking without having to give away a history of thinking about a technology in a different way. When you look out to the market, you cited Rwanda earlier, where do you see those new beacons of technology development and innovation, those areas that aren't the traditional London's, China's, Silicon Valley's? Where are the new beacons of digital innovation?
Well, those new beacons are absolutely shining throughout Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Those new beacons are starting to flimmer and will shine in Latin America and Central America. I'm absolutely confident that those beacons will be tomorrow's unicorns.
Yes. I wanted to, you've obviously worked in the industry for many, many years. You've invested in many businesses, and you must be incredibly well networked in that tech space. And I wanted to ask you a question around the sort of the phenomenon of the highly charismatic leader in technology businesses. It almost becomes, in some regards, a cult of personality. And then you see that leader leave for whatever reason they may do from a high profile business. In your view, how does a business keep that culture of innovation going and that passion and that drive for innovation after that charismatic individual leaves? And where do you see good examples of that in action at the moment?
Well, sometimes that charismatic individual doesn't leave.
It's another story, I guess. Yes.
That's another story.
Yes. I can think of one or two right at the moment.
Absolutely. We're probably on the same wavelength.
Yes. Yeah.
But I guess in good tech, there's a submerging of egos.
Mm-hmm.
So that allows for people not to sort of build and create and innovate around a cult leader.
Mm-hmm.
Because in tech, the most inspiring leaders are collaborative. They're team players.
Yeah.
It's never about them.
I guess further to that, I would like to ask another question around what I see sometimes in the tech startup space, and well, in any business for that matter, and that is that the characteristics that are needed in a founder to get that business off the ground, to launch it and grow it at scale quickly, are not always the same characteristics that are needed on an ongoing business to continue to grow their business and expand. Do you see this challenge in some of the businesses you invest in and the mentors you work, the mentees you work with? And if so, how do you address that? How do we, to go back to your point around ego, how do we ensure that egos aren't dented in the process of growing that business and perhaps bringing a new leader on?
Well, one shining example of that is Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when they were going through their early stage funding rounds in Silicon Valley. And at the time, Jack was the CEO. And so they weren't getting funding. And so a very forthright and honest investor said, well, if the leadership team was reversed, if you weren't the CEO and the CTO was the CEO, you would get venture backing.
Yes.
And this is what I was saying earlier, how egos are submerged.
Yes.
They did it and they got funding.
Some of the natural, the tech giants, Twitter and others, are almost natural monopolies in their sectors. You know, when we think about certain social media areas or sectors, we can think about two or three big names, and they are heads and shoulders above the rest in that area. So they almost become natural monopolies. And I wondered what you believe their responsibility is in return for that privilege.
I think their responsibility in return for their privilege and their global prominence is to be responsible and to be a good tech company, not a destructive tech company. As you know, in the UK, the inquest on Molly Russell.
Mm-hmm.
That was last month. And if it had not been for the dogged determination of her parents,
yes,
tech companies would not have been held accountable for doing harm and damage.
How do we, I mean, that was a very, very sad case, and unfortunately it's not an isolated one. How, what is the next step to changing that? Does it come from regulation? Does it come from legislation? Does it come from a proactive approach from the tech companies? Where does the impetus need to come from? Because it's something that doesn't, that seems very resistant to change.
I think the impetus has to come from this fundamental understanding that what you're building, what you're creating, what you're innovating, humans are using, humans are consuming it, not robots. And I think if that understanding is just ingrained in the DNA of development and innovation, we'll see less harm.
Do you see that in the conversations you're having, whether it's at Norskin or otherwise? Do you see that fundamental shift coming, that humans, consumers, users aren't just seen as data points, but are actually seen as themselves, as humans? Do you see that in the conversations you're having?
Absolutely. In the conversations I'm having and in the entrepreneurs, global entrepreneurs that are just stepping up and committed to the challenges, the real challenges of this world.
Another area where concern has been expressed, as well as incredible potential, is the metaverse, and it's obviously capturing both the imagination and the investment of the VC community. But the more I research about the potential of the metaverse, the more I see two very polarized views, that either it is firmly the future or that it is fully a fantasy, an emperor's new clothes, if you like. As someone who was in that space and having weekly conversations, I'm sure, around investing in it, what is your view? What is the potential of the metaverse?
Well, based on the conversations I'm having, there is a future in the metaverse space. And it's decentralizing. It's making things more accessible. And also, I remember when we had the global pandemic and all the universities and colleges, you know, they sent their students back home. And at the time, my son was in university. And it was a personal eye opener for me to see the genius behind the metaverse and also behind augmented reality.
Yes.
It really was a godsend to students during the pandemic.
How do we ensure that in taking advantage of all of the opportunity in the metaverse, that those challenges that we discussed earlier with social media platforms in terms of privacy, security, the type of content that exists on those channels, that they aren't just simply replicated in the virtual world? What do we need to ensure that there is a better balance of safety, security, and content in that metaverse?
Well, I think the regulatory agencies and bodies, they are doing an excellent job of reining in, you know, sort of this monster. Because it is. I mean, the metaverse can be a huge monster, but if it's regulated and reined in, privacy is protected.
Yes.
Confidentiality is protected. It becomes a safer space instead of something damaging.
Juliette Marie, as we come to the end of the conversation, it's been wonderful. So thank you very much for a very engaging conversation. I would love to get your view of what continues to inspire you as an entrepreneur, as an investor, as a mentor, an advisor, about the tech space or more generally about business. You've broken many of these glass ceilings. You continue to inspire others, but what inspires you in that regard?
I think what inspires me most on a daily basis is the work and the journey that I have with global entrepreneurs who are, in some cases, saving lives and making the world a better place. I've spent decades in the professional world and with my career. And I can honestly say I couldn't be in a happier place.
Well, that's a wonderful place to end the podcast on. And I'm very pleased to hear that. That is that's a lovely sentiment. Juliette Marie, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Paul.
My pleasure. If you'd like to learn more about what Juliette Marie and her team do, please go to somersetcapital.ai, and you will also find the links in the notes that accompany this podcast. And if you've enjoyed this episode or any of the other episodes of the new P&L, I encourage you to either rate us or review us. It all helps with our ratings and our rankings. And I invite you to also send a link to your colleagues, your associates, anyone who you think might benefit from the new P&L, our approach to principled leadership, and purpose-led business. So finally, I'm Paul, host of the new P&L. Thank you once again for listening, and have a great day.